read you a little bit from Anne Lamott's book, Stitches. This is how she starts the book. And I think in this couple of pages, she does the thing that Anne Lamott does as well as anyone, which is be candid. It can be too sad here. We so often lose our way. It's easy to sense and embrace meaning when life is on track. When there's a feeling of fullness, having love, goodness, family, work, maybe God as parts of life, it's easier to navigate around the sadness that you inevitably stumble across. Life holds beauty, magic, and anguish. Sometimes sorrow is unavoidable, even when your kids are little, when the marvels of your children and your parental amazement are all the meaning you need to sustain you, or when you've landed the job and salary for which you've always longed, or the mate. And then the phone rings, the mail comes, you turn on the TV. Where do we even begin in the presence of evil or catastrophe? Deep or deeply lost children, young wife's melanoma, polar bears floating out to sea on scraps of ice. What is the point of it all when we experience the vortex of interminable depression, or conversely, when we recognize that time is tearing past us like giddy greyhounds? It's frightening and disorienting that time skates by so fast, and while it's not as bad as being embedded in the quicksand of loss, we're filled with dread each time we notice life hot-footed out of town. One rarely knows where to begin the search for meaning, though by necessity, we can only start where we are. That would be fine when where we find ourselves turns out to be bearable. What about when it isn't? After 9/11, for instance, or a suicide in the family. I really don't have a clue. I do know it somehow has to do with sticking together as we try to make sense of chaos, and that seems a way to begin. We could start with something relatively easy. C.S. Lewis famously said about forgiveness, if we really want to know how to forgive, perhaps we'd better start with something easier than the Gestapo. Indeed, Mr. Lewis. So, we are... We're of necessity vehicle shopping. I remember as a young man phoning my father from a car dealer. I was looking at this Jeep CJ7, and I phoned my dad basically to say, what do you think? Because it wasn't his money, it was mine. I'd earned it and I was about to spend it, and I knew he wouldn't be a bottom liner about it, but I really wanted his approval, I think his blessing, you know, his wisdom. So I phoned him as I was in another town. I said, I made the mistake of using the word investment in the sentence while purchasing an automobile. And Dad said, well, do whatever you want, son, but don't ever make the mistake of thinking about a vehicle as an investment. It's always and only an expense. And time has proved him right. We've expended and expended on our existing van to the point where it has almost 400,000 kilometers on it and arguably owes us nothing. So out of necessity, we're vehicle shopping. So I was in a vehicle with a car salesman who really didn't understand me. He really, I think, honestly thought that perhaps he could just ingratiate himself relationally to me, with me to the point where I'd buy a car from him, which I appreciated the effort, and it was a lovely experience, but it has absolutely no bearing on the way I shop for a vehicle. But anyway, I get in the vehicle, and he just starts right in about Robin Williams, how sad and how much impact this guy's film work had on his life. And we've had a couple other conversations, so it was a little bit of a relational baseline, but he just dove right into the deep water of his own kind of grief about the loss of a, you know, popular icon. So I kind of had that rattling around in my head and in my heart when I opened up the current McLean's and read one of my favorite columnists in here, Emma Tidal. It was kind of like their young adult generation's columnist, and a snappy writer and an interesting thinker. I often enjoy what she has to say. And she and another one of their regular columnists both wrote a short piece about Williams. And she describes herself as a child of the 90s, somebody who grew up with Robin Williams' work. And she writes about how, for her generation, the loss of Robin Williams was the loss of someone that taught her generation what things meant. It was really interesting. She describes it this way. She says, Williams was a serious actor, and the roles that will immortalize him in the minds of critics are those in Good Will Hunting, Dead Poets Society, and Good Morning Vietnam. But the roles that immortalize him in the minds of my generation are his least sophisticated. Daniel Hillard in Mrs. Doubtfire, a middle-aged man in geriatric drag who teaches us way ahead of his time that families come in all different sizes and shapes. Peter Banning in Hook, an overworked lawyer turned oversized Peter Pan who teaches us that family comes before monetary wealth. Professor Philip Brainerd in Flubber, who invents and befriends a Pillsbury Doughboy-esque creature made of green translucent goo. And Dr. Hunter Adams in Patch Adams, an unconventional medical practitioner who indulges an elderly patient's fantasy of swimming in a gigantic bowl of noodle soup and teaches us that laughter is always the best medicine. If you grew up on Robin Williams, he wasn't merely a manic comedian. He was the center of your moral universe. Isn't that interesting? I put these things together in the context of what I've been reflecting on through the week and what I wanted to kind of explore together this evening, and I thought that our search for meaning is a really potent one. We will do this. We will try to make sense of this thing called life. We will do it, as Anne Lamott says, when life is happy. We'll do it when it's sad. We can't not. And we'll work with what we've got. And one of the things that we have are stories. And that's one of the reasons why I think Williams had such an enormous impact, is because he surrendered himself so thoroughly to the stories that he was telling. Told them your sense was in his style as a comic actor in particular, with all the energy that he had, with whatever he could bring to it. I think that's one of the reasons he was so captivating. I mean, I've got four kids, and so I feel like I've spent an awful lot of my life, percentage-wise, reading them stories. It could sound like a complaint. It's not. I love a good story, and I hope that as my kids grow up, they're going to love good stories, too. I think I already see that happening. I feel hopeful about it. And Davis just won an essay contest, the paper for which was submitted by a prof who liked his paper, but it was in a discipline that he's not majoring in. And so he seems to have figured out how to tell a story as an essayist. Cale had finished a 3-volume work of fiction before he was 16. I'm not saying it was good fiction, but it was voluminous fiction, and so at least captivated by story. You know, I mean, these kids they're getting it, right? They know there's something in there. I love that. And I think one of the reasons good stories are captivating is because they put a picture in our imagination that sticks with us. And listen to read Emma Tittle's column and realize, man, these characters that Williams portrayed, the stories that he told and was part of telling as an actor, they are lodged in her imagination, in her, by her own confession, in her moral imagination, in the part of her way of looking at the universe with which and through which she decides how to be a moral actor in the story that she lives, how to live her life around questions of good and evil. That's powerful stuff, right? And this is, I was listening to Obama today with his carefully worded, I'm back from my vacation in Martha's Vineyard to deal with the beheading of this photojournalist statement. And I was listening to him say this changes nothing, and realizing that this faction that did the beheading has said we will continue, we'll behead another journalist if America continues its attacks, and Obama's saying this changes nothing about our commitment to those attacks. And I was trying to imagine what it's like for him to go on vacation. How do you do that? Well, you don't, right? I mean, how do you make a decision like that? How do you live in that? Moral imagination. How do you exercise your moral imagination in the straits you are betwixt when you are a world leader? Well, one of the ways you do it, of course, is you act out of the stories that you carry in your imagination. We live out of this stuff way more, I think, than we usually are conscious of living. The stickiness of stories, though, I mean, having read Lord of the Rings or seen the films, maybe even more, because one of the things filmmakers do for good or for ill is fill in the visual part of our imagination, right? They kind of go there by their vision, and then we see that vision. But it tends to go in and be pretty sticky sometimes. So I can't get the moment of Gandalf, you know, fly, you fools! Like, I can't get that thing out of my head. And there's other moments in those films that will be different for different people. But that stuff is like burrs in my mental socks. It's just stuck in there. I've got another example. This one's a little less likely to be common currency, partly because it's a composite, so it probably only exists in my mind. But it's made up of moments from a bunch of different stories. And it's the moment in a different story settings where someone is digging for something important. And the text that we're going to explore is this text in Matthew 13, 44. Jesus has a whole string of parables in Matthew 13, but some of them are these really short, little pithy ones. And Matthew 13, 44 is one of those. It's this little one-verse parable where Jesus says, "The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went out and sold all he had and bought that field." And the image that's in my mind is a moment when somebody is digging for treasure. But the moment that sticks with me really firmly is not the moment when they find it and pull it out of the sand. You know, like the movie moment where they lift the chest out and this impossibly dry, clean sand kind of slithers off, shushes off this kind of river of sand, and there's this iron-bound chest. And it's not that moment. It's the moment where they're digging and they push the shovel into the dirt and it goes kunk. All we see is the dirt and the shovel and the digger. You know, we're not seeing any treasure. We're just kunk. You know, that's the moment for me. That's the thing that in my mind, and I can hear that inside the character's head, I kind of get this, I was digging here because X marked the spot, but it still comes as a complete and utter surprise that there's this clink of metal on metal, that there's this encounter with what I was looking for but haven't found yet. And my heart just stops for a split second and then just starts to pound like mad because I'm thinking this is it. This is what I've been looking for all this time. This is why I came here with the shovel. This is why I was digging. This is the thing. I don't know if you've ever noticed or not, if you've ever thought about how that's the moment in the story of buried treasure that often reveals an awful lot about the character of the digger. And think about it. If the digger is Long John Silver, if the digger is like a paranoid pirate, what does he do? He looks around, first of all, to see if anybody else is watching. If they're not, that's fine. He keeps digging. If they are, he pulls out his pistol and shoots them. He just eliminates all the competition for the treasure. And if it's Johnny Depp, he makes a big-eyed funny face and gets another $20 million. If it's a starving man, if the treasure that the person is digging for is essential to survival, then this is the part of the story where, in my imagination, he throws away the shovel and he starts to dig with his bare hands and he tears off his fingernails and he bloodies his palms because he has to have what he's digging for. He's dead without it. Or maybe this is the moment in the story where the digger just cuts loose and does a crazy dance on the beach and he doesn't care who sees it. He's like a lottery winner bursting into the Hallelujah Chorus in a 7-Eleven. You know, it's just kind of crazy, but he doesn't care. I'm a winner. I got it. I found it, you know. I'm not exactly sure why that moment in the stories is so captivating for me, but I think part of the reason is because that's the moment in the story where, for me, the element of mystery is so lively. And we're digging around in this metaphor. We're digging around here because we have reason to suspect that there's a treasure hidden in the vicinity. We're convinced enough to dig, even though whatever might be there isn't visible to everyone, so we might look pretty stupid if we get caught at it. But we're hopeful, or maybe we're just desperate. Whatever map or counsel we've been following has led us this far, to this spot, and we're convinced enough, and so we dig. But in all likelihood, we don't really know what we're digging for. Well, we know it's a treasure. We think we know it's a treasure. But if we follow up on that clink, What will we actually find? Could be we're too late, right? Could be that when we do find whatever the treasure is, the lock will be shattered and the box will be empty, and the Pharaoh's tomb will be bare to the walls, you know. And then we're really going to look stupid. It's an interesting thing about this little pithy little text here in Matthew. The original word that's translated hidden, kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. The word that's translated hidden in that text, it's a participle of a verb. I'm not going to get too technical here, but it shows up in a few different places in the Bible, and in most of those instances, like in this one, it shows up in the text to emphasize the idea of mystery. I'll give you just a couple of examples. Matthew 11, chapter 25, Jesus is talking in that text about the cities that have paid no attention to the works by which he's proclaiming the kingdom, the signs of his. And he says this, he says, "I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden," same verb, "these things from the wise and learned." And then in Luke 18, Jesus has just foretold his death and resurrection for the third time, and this time he's spelled it out in so many words. He said, "I'm going to die and I'm going to rise from the dead," and he's just like laid it out for the disciples. And Luke, as Luke tells the story, he says the disciples, quote, "did not understand any of these things, and this word was hidden," same verb, "from them, and they did not know what he was talking about." Same idea. It was obscured. It was buried. It's a bit of a treasure map moment in this story, right? The precise nature of what we're digging for in our spiritual search isn't clear, but what is clear is that it's a big deal. It's not some kind of an, we're not digging for some kind of an invisible proposition, some kind of an idea that if we don't bother it, it won't bother us. We're poking around trying to find the center of the story. We're trying to find the thing that Lamont's writing about here. We're trying to find the thing that the Newsweek columnist is writing about. We're trying to find a way to make sense and meaning of the whole thing. We're trying to find the central proposition, the constitutive principle of the whole order of things. I guess to put it another way, if we were going to just put it into the words that this parable of treasure in the field uses, what we're looking for is exactly what that parable says. We're looking for something that's worth selling anything we have to sell in order to enjoy possessing it. Like that's what we're looking for. We're looking for the big deal. And so far in this text, we've got images of one person looking for one item. But I think that's where this parable actually invites us to expand our imagination even further. The image of a field is a pretty common one in Jesus' seed parables. And he uses this agricultural imagery a number of times. But usually, when Jesus uses the image of a field in a parable, it functions as a surrogate for the whole world. Right? That's kind of what it stands in for. But I think in this one, that image gets a little bit upended. And here's kind of why I think that. Even though the imagery in this parable has the treasure hidden in only one spot, it's not broadcast everywhere, or two if you count wherever it gets rehidden, it's not throughout the field, there's still a visible theme of Catholicity, of everywhereness, I think, in this story. And here's the twist. Instead of the treasure being hidden everywhere, as the mystery is in other texts, the mystery is broadcast in the other texts. In this case, the everywhereness of the parable has to do with the response of those that find the treasure. Here's what I mean by that. Most of us would be familiar with the saying, in for a penny, in for a pound. We tend to use it when our marriages are being challenging, or when our investments are underperforming, or when our kids are acting like they belong to some other inferior family, you know. Well, in for a penny, in for a pound. But the saying is a financial metaphor. It's just that it's not in our currency, right? It's in the currency of the UK. But did you ever notice, when you think about that idea, did you ever notice that the smart businessman in the parable doesn't just buy the bit of the field that contains the treasure? He doesn't. He buys the whole field to get the treasure, to put it into that little folk truism. He has to be in for a penny, in for a pound. He has to buy the whole field. He has to buy the bit that has the treasure in it, as well as the bit that's swampy, the part that's a Scotch broom thicket, the part that's full of rocks, and the part that's scrub oak. And he has to buy all the shit piles and all the mosquitoes and all the ticks that come with it. He has to buy the whole field, right? That's what he has to do if he wants the treasure. But the treasure, as Jesus reminds us here, is a mystery. And if we want to not just find the treasure, but stand for it, and that is, by which I mean, represent it in some way in the world, which is sort of what Jesus says that the people who walk in the way of Jesus should do, then we need to be ready to buy the whole field, to act like owners that are present to everything that's on the land, the stuff that's good, the stuff that's bad, the stuff that's ugly, the whole shooting match. When I think about our life as a community, when I think about the table, and I think about what we're trying to make a place for, a place that's safe to explore spiritually, I think one of the essential things for us to keep trying to learn is how to trust the goodness of God enough to act as though this community, in this iteration and in many others, could be becoming a place where we don't have to come all tidied up. I don't mean that, you know, externally as much as internally. I mean it in the storied sense. I mean it in the sense that we don't have to come here feeling like either we have to have our lives sorted out before we come, or we have to act like we have them sorted out when we come, or when we're with the people that we know from this community. And one of the reasons I think that's so important is because I think that's one of the only ways to make safety for the whole field to have any sense of comfort in a community, is for the community to press into that terrain itself. This is not a thing you flick a switch and do, as far as I can tell. This is hard stuff to learn and hard stuff to practice and just hard stuff to do. It's not simple, and it never will be, because our inclination to self-protection, to retreat from being who we were made to be, from being free, our retreat from that is vigorous and multi-layered and I would say sophisticated, except that the thing that we're trying to do is so bonehead stupid and backwards. I don't want to use that word for it. Complex. It's certainly complex. But if we think about a story like this little one that Jesus is telling, I think about that moment that so captivates me of the clink of encounter with mystery. And I think that sound, that dunk, ooh, what's this? That sound is not a signal to buy the cubic yard of soil where we heard the noise so we can keep it for ourselves. It's a signal to buy the whole field of humanity, all the colors, all the genders, the smart, the stupid, the smelly, the well-washed, the spiritual, the non-spiritual. It's not a signal to hoard something. And I think to the degree, if you will, to the degree is a one-to-one kind of correlation. I'd cancel that. As we move into that kind of terrain, I think there is a correlation, a mysterious, kind of murky one, but I think it's real. There is a correlation between pressing into a way of life that says that we have enough trust, or we wish to have enough trust in a God that is good enough and big enough to bear that we can move into the whole field of the world around us. Good, bad, ugly, lovely, unlovely, tillable, apparently untillable. Everything in between. We can move into that in such a way that when the treasure is finally revealed, whatever that looks like, there's just a chance, and maybe just a little greater chance, that we will all get to do a happy dance together on the beach. In my imagination, at least, that's a great reason for a community to exist, and it's a great reason to keep pressing into mystery. Peace.